is total from in history, and it was driven by a lot of the U.S. companies, very profitable U.S. companies this year. I'm curious to see what happens on next year's list with all the tariffs that are being levied to see what the effect is
Just very
on
quick.
the 2025 results.
Just very quickly, Scott, 15 seconds on the Chinese impact here. They haven't broken through yet, but will they?
The China firms over the past couple of years were outpacing the U.S. companies. Now we're seeing it going the other way, where the U.S. companies are having a bigger presence on the list. What I think I did see a year ago, there were more profitable Chinese firms in the top 10, and this year it was dominated by the U.S. companies, even though there was one Chinese firm that was among the top 10 in profitability. So there's definitely a shift in the global business economy.
Okay, well, let's talk again next year, and let's see who's there. Maybe you and my company will be there. That's it from me today. I'll be back at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Producer was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden's pressing the button. But up next on Times Radio, it's the mighty duo, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And this is the point at which I say you're not so bad yourself, Trevor. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio until four.
And in those 2 hours, Donald Trump leaves our shores when this programme ends, at last showing us a proper sense of deference. Have Scotland's leaders managed to charm him? We'll get the latest from the Times. A year on from the Southport attacks, we'll hear more about how the town is remembering Alice, Bebe and Elsie. Our big interview is with Casper Lee, a YouTuber, one of the internet's earliest stars. He's now a deeply savvy businessman and tech investor. We have much to learn. And your health news with our resident GP, Rachel Ward.
And here's the news at two from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Nigel Farage has demanded an apology from the technology secretary, who claimed the reform leader's opposition to online safety laws means he's on the side of predators, including the late Jimmy Savile. Farage says the comments by Peter Kyle are disgusting. Reform describes the Online Safety Act as dystopian, claiming it forces social media companies to censor anti-government speech. Darren Grimes, Reform's deputy leader of Durham County Council, has told Times Radio that Mr. Kyle's comments are out of order.
Quite frankly, I think that's an absolutely puerile, juvenile, disgusting remark to actually pass across. I think ultimately, yeah, we have a problem with children accessing things online. Of course we do. But that needs to lead to better parental restrictions and ultimately the social media giants, which they have been, moving in the right direction to censor and get rid of these kinds of pieces of content.
Thousands of England fans have cheered their heroes as the Lionesses celebrated their Euro 2025 victory in central London.
Seeing this amount of people supporting the women's team and women's football is, it's amazing.
It's a massive boost for girls' football as well. So more and more girls, because of this, want to play.
What an atmosphere, isn't it?
Fabulous. Wouldn't have missed it for the world.
An open-top bus parade down the mile was followed by the players taking to the stage outside Buckingham Palace, where they lifted the trophy again. England sealed back-to-back European titles with victory over Spain in Sunday's final. Sir Keir Starmer has recalled his cabinet from summer recess for an urgent meeting on Gaza this afternoon. Israel denies it's responsible for mass starvation there after two Israeli human rights organisations accused its government of committing genocide. The Prime Minister is facing mounting pressure to recognise Palestinian statehood. Kemi Badenoch says it would be the right move.
There is a humanitarian crisis that needs to be addressed. He should be talking about dropping aid packages, making sure that an international effort is being coordinated to look after the people who are suffering. There is a war on.
At least 17 people have died in a Russian airstrike on a prison in Ukraine's Zaporizhia region. Ukrainian officials say more than 80 others have been injured, with the jail's dining hall destroyed and administrative buildings damaged. Around 42 inmates went to hospital. Russia has not yet commented. The police commissioner of New York says a gunman who killed four people in a shooting at a skyscraper had a documented mental health history. The building on Park Avenue houses the headquarters of the NFL, the investment company BlackRock, and the Irish consulate. The 27-year-old suspect shot himself dead. Patrick Hendry from the Police Benevolent Association says an officer was among those killed.
We're hurting for our brother police officer who we lost. We're hurting for that family. We're hurting for all the victims and hurting for all the families of the victims. And we're all asking why.
Fans will be able to pay their final respects to Ozzy Osbourne as his body is brought back to his home city of Birmingham for a procession. It's been confirmed his hearse will also stop at the Black Sabbath Bridge and bench ahead of his funeral tomorrow afternoon. Thousands have gathered there since his death last week. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon and you're very welcome. We are here until 4 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover and the WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. So what lies ahead this afternoon? Well, Ramblin' Don, he's on his way home from Scotland in a couple of hours. Today he's got on really well, splendidly, with the current Scottish First Minister John Swinney. And Mr Trump has also opened his new golf course in Aberdeenshire. I have to say, one of his sons was wearing an absolutely horrific pair of trousers. I don't know what it is about golfing slacks.
Is that Eric?
Oh, is he the tall one?
Yeah, he's the in charge of golf clubs one.
Well, he needs to be in charge of his trousers. He isn't at the moment.
Were they a tartan trousers?
No, they're just very, very tight. And I'm sorry, none of us needed to see them. A business associate of Roman Abramovich has lost his attempt to have sanctions against him overturned. I'm going to ask whether sanctions really work. Health news with Dr. Rachel Ward. There'll be a range of serious issues discussed, of course, but we must ask whether Mariah Carey's defiant diet of Norwegian salmon and capers will indeed guarantee her immortality. It's in the Times today. No doubt you've enjoyed that article. Mariah simply does not recognise the ageing process.
Well, she has definitely told her face that, and her face has responded by agreeing with her. She looks absolutely blooming amazing, Jane.
It's hard to tell what her face is thinking, but yeah, okay, let's go with your, I think, very generous assessment of Mariah Carey's ageing. Still, she doesn't recognise time, so it's impossible to pin the woman down. Now, in a world of pain...
Maybe she just doesn't know how old she is then.
Possible. We are unashamedly on Times Radio continuing to sing the praises of the still partying, though many have now taken to wearing dark glasses, lionesses. Today it was the bus trip down the Mall, and I have to say the unexpected vision of that very good-natured 55-year-old Dutch woman, Serena Wiegmann, dancing with Burna Boy. I hadn't emotionally been prepared for that.
No. I know you weren't, but I'm glad that you had the same reaction that many in the crowd had, which was one of real delight, because Serena definitely doesn't know it's about to happen.
She doesn't.
Of those terrible Michael Aspel, This Is Your Life moments where you have to pretend that you're glad to see a person who you knew was coming all along.
That third cousin you've tried to ignore for years who's
exactly
flown in
that
from Australia.
So she gives it a good old bit of welly. She knows all of the words. Burna Boy looks a little confused, but he's definitely glad to be there. And it's wonderful, actually. The whole blooming thing, Jane, is absolutely wonderful.
It is wonderful. You have to... when did they organise this? I mean, is Burna Boy... was he told to keep the date available?
I would imagine so.
It's extraordinary.
Because not everybody was as pessimistic as you were in your interview with Jill Scott.
No, come on, ages ago now. Who's the big guest? It's Casper Lee. And on behalf of many Times Radio listeners, Fee... who is he?
So Casper Lee is somebody who your kids or your grandkids will definitely know. He's one of the first YouTubers. He did quite a lot of work with Joe Sugg. They did all of the pranks, the self-deprecating humour. They lived their teenage lives online and they got millions and millions and millions of hits and subscribers. But Casper Lee's a very interesting guy because he did all of that in his late teens and early 20s and then just thought, no, I don't want to still be here in my 30s and 40s. I want to use all of the knowledge that I've gained as a content creator and turn that into understanding the business behind the screens. So that's what he's done. So he's got a talent agency. He's got a marketing, global marketing agency, which deals exclusively with influencers. He's become a venture capitalist investing in other tech companies. There's an awful lot to learn from Casper Lee. He's only 31.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. So Casper Lee live here on Times Radio after 3:30 this afternoon. A brief look at the most read stories on the Times website.
In at number 3 is this this horrendous New York shooting. Gunman kills police officer and three others. The 27-year-old suspect, who has been named as Shane Tamura, opened fire in a midtown Manhattan skyscraper before killing himself. The second most read story is Farage Khan and Lady Starmer, Trump's chaotic press conference. That's looking back to what happened at exactly this time, actually, 24 hours ago. It was yesterday's 88-minute-long extravaganza with the Prime Minister and the President. And the most read piece on the Times website is North Sea oil is a treasure chest for the UK. That is from Donald Trump. The comment has been made today ahead of his departure from Scotland, and we'll talk more about his trip in just a moment. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription all together now in harmony. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Well, we're going to Donald Trump and to Scotland right now, in fact. That visit almost over, finishes at around about 4 o'clock our time. Today, the American president has had meetings with the Scottish First Minister, John Swinney, and the Scottish Labour leader, Anna Sawa, along with the important business of, yes, opening a new Trump golf course in Aberdeenshire. So here is a selection of some of his bits.
It's fantastic to be here. Thank you for your hospitality and to see this amazing golf course. I'll invite you to a football ground at some stage and we can exchange sports.
You'll see some of the ugliest windmills you've ever seen. They're the height of a 50-story building. You can take 1,000 times more energy out of a hole in the ground this big. This big. It's called oil and gas. And you have it there, the North Sea.
John Swinney, who's a terrific guy and loves golf.
I'm not a fan of your mayor. I think he's done a terrible job, the mayor of London. But the nasty person, I think he's done...
He's a friend of mine, actually.
September the 17th.
Yes, exactly. Not long to wait, everybody. Six weeks until Donald makes his return.
Oh, babe, I hate to go.
Well, you might hate to go, but some of us would be quite glad to see the back of you. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Other people, big admirers. Thanks to Ryan for that.
Who's a terrific guy and loves golf. And
thank you, yes. Katrina Stewart has been covering Trump's visit for The Times. Hello, Katrina. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm well, thank you.
So how are we about this idea of mixing private business with a public role as leader of the free world? It is all a bit bizarre, isn't it, if we're honest?
It's pretty complicated. Donald Trump, of course, was supposed to be on holiday. The idea was that he was coming here to inspect his golf courses and open up this new golf course in Aberdeenshire. But he has very much mixed business with pleasure. We knew all along that there would be the meeting with Keir Starmer, that he would be meeting with John Swinney. But then he chucked in a bit of Ursula von der Leyen at the end as well. So it has been a very heavily political and politicised working holiday for Donald Trump.
Yes, but everybody is happy with the idea that Donald Trump is in this unique position of apparently being completely free to combine his private business interests with being the democratically elected of the president of the United States of America. Is that okay?
I think it raises big questions about the funding for this trip. It has been of huge cost to the public purse in Scotland around policing. It has diverted police from other matters that are going to have knock-on effects in Scotland in the coming weeks. There's been surprisingly little political pushback against that, though. The Scottish Greens had raised it, but it is an extraordinary way for the leader of the free world to be conducting himself. You can't quite imagine any other US president using his position of influence to promote his business interests. But there hasn't been much criticism here. I think for John Swinney, our First Minister, he's just been glad to grab the opportunity to try and promote Scotland on the world stage.
And I'm sure he has indeed done exactly that, or attempted to. But on the face of it, John Swinney and Donald Trump wouldn't have anything in common at all. How did they get on?
Surprisingly well. John Swinney seems to have been able to win Donald Trump around. I think the president is just so delighted with his golf course that he's managed to set any potential grievances aside, because of course John Swinney has been vocally critical of Donald Trump in the past and was a Kamala Harris supporter in the presidential race. But he seems to have done pretty well in both meetings. Donald Trump was asked yesterday about whiskey tariffs, didn't really seem to know what was going on. He said that he's not a whiskey drinker himself, whereas today John Swinney is saying that he raised the issue of whiskey tariffs and Donald Trump has told him to speak to the US ambassador. It's put that issue on the radar, so that has been a success for John Swinney. And today he was given a special mention at the launch of the golf course in Aberdeenshire. He was told to stand up and give a wave to everyone. So he seems to have flattered the Donald successfully.
Yeah, well, that's the game you've absolutely got to play. So what about the Scottish Labour leader? What about him and his relationship with Donald Trump? Have they met?
They have met previously. They didn't meet on this trip, but Anna Sarwar was asked about the same issues that we're talking about here, about whether Donald Trump should be mixing business with pleasure, what a relationship would be like between Scottish Labour, Anna Sarwar, and Donald Trump should he become First Minister next year, because of course we have the Holyrood elections next year. And he said that his position would be that around business rather than politics. He said that he would want to use Trump to showcase that Scotland's open for business, that you can come here and invest in Scotland and that be a success. So I think Anna Sarwar and Donald Trump would not be politically in step on many issues, but he again is being very diplomatic because he has an eye on Bute House next year and he doesn't want to be too critical of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, maybe we should have just a quick look at how the polls are playing out for next year's Scottish parliamentary elections. The SNP are still leading, aren't they?
The SNP are still leading, not by very much. It's looking quite unstable at the moment. We've had a couple of by-elections that have thrown up some surprises. Scottish Labour was seen to be really struggling because of the knock-on effect of decisions being made at Westminster, but actually they've had some by-election successes recently that have really reinvigorated them. The rise of Reform is a huge issue as well. There's polling that's suggesting that Reform could secure as many as 18 MSPs next year, which would really reshape what the Scottish Parliament looks like. So it really is all to play for at the moment.
Yeah, but that's because of PR, is it?
It is, yes, of course. We have a version of proportional representation, so our parliament looks a bit different from Westminster. And there, of course, is the constitutional question, whether there would be a pro-independence majority next year, or whether that question is just not as important to voters this time around. So we have a lot of different factors in the mix.
Yeah, really interesting. Thank you very much indeed. That is Katrina Stewart reporting for us from Scotland.
Mary makes a very good point. President Carter had to put his peanut farm into trust when he was in office. But this, and I won't use that word, but thank you, Mary, openly conducts his business in front of the world and, as usual, gets away with it. And I think it's such an important point that maybe isn't being made often enough. I mean, this is a man who is visiting his business ventures, isn't it? And then treating us to his political insight, knowledge and ability to pop in on political neighbours. I mean, it is, to a lot of people, a very distasteful combination, not least those people in Scotland who want to be able to vociferously demonstrate against him, who are being asked to, you know, keep off private land for a public visit. It's odd. There are lots of odd things going down.
The whole thing is very odd. And we were talking a little bit about this, weren't we, in our podcast, Off Air, with Jane and Fee.
What happens in Off Air, Jane?
Well, no one knows. But it comes out at about 6 o'clock, Monday to Thursday. We were both just talking earlier on, when we recorded it, about how all this is going to be viewed in a decade or so time. I mean, either things will have stayed the same, things will be as they still are, or things will be, people will have, personnel on the world stage will have changed, memoirs will have been written, and we'll find out perhaps what Keir Starmer was really thinking
24 hours ago as he sat there next to Donald Trump at Turnberry.
I hope he's keeping a journal.
So do I. Coming up, football is well and truly home. We know that. But here's a little tease for you. Which of the Lionesses had such a good time over the last 48 hours they can't even remember the party? You're listening to Jane and Feet here on Times Radio. It is 18 minutes past two.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Hello, it's Callum and Rosie. While Kate and Stig are enjoying their summer holidays, speaking of which, we'll consider the busy summer the government's dealing with and bring you the outcome of the emergency cabinet meeting on Gaza.
Trump jets back to the US from Scotland, so what waits for him at home and in our own cabinet meeting? The former Conservative Minister Edwina Curry and the Times writer and big thinker Matthew Said will join us from 9.
Times Radio Breakfast. Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Play the opening game of Final One Standing by William Hill for your chance to win a share of a £500,000 jackpot. It's free to play. Simply join the opening league before 12:30 on Saturday, 16th of August, and pick a team to win in the opening round. Then pick a team to win each week. You can only pick each team once, and if you're the final one standing, then the jackpot is yours. Final One Standing by William Hill. Football's ultimate elimination game. 18 plus online. Runs from 28th of July 2025. Price split if all players lose in the same round. Paid in 48 hours. T's and C's apply. Play responsibly.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Right, have a listen to this. Well, that is the sound of the ecstatic Lionesses team lifting their latest trophy. They've been celebrating their Euros title defence with a parade through central London, ending outside Buckingham Palace today. England's stalwart Lucy Bronze was amongst those who spoke, paying tribute to her teammates.
Just thank you so much to each and every one of them. I think they all know how much they all mean to me and to each other. I think the group effort that we had in this tournament was unbelievable. From every single player, 1 to 23, it was... I've never seen anything like it. Every single day in training, every single game, before games, after games, every single player has played such a huge part in the history of what this team's created this summer.
And how was the party compared to last time?
Don't remember.
Well, do you know what? I don't think that clip conveys the atmosphere down at the Mall, because it's been incredible. 65,000 people. I mean, it's been a party, hasn't it?
It has been a party, and they have been gathering there since midnight. Like, it's been hours that some of them have been queuing just to get to the front spot. I mean, they wanted to be close to the likes of Lucy Bronze. Lucy Bronze, I'm not surprised she can't remember the party. I mean, if I'd won the Euros with a fractured tibia, I'd be partying all night like that. But it's just incredible. Leah Williamson as well, the captain, spoke, and the pure emotion in her voice. She said she cried the whole way down the Mall, and looking at the fans just lining, even in St James's Park, it was just packed with fans there. I spoke to a fan who was just 4 years old, and she was so excited. She said, "I just want to see Michelle Adjumang." And that's the power that these Lionesses have, I think. They just want to be like these women who have achieved something amazing, whether that's in football or any other industry. I think seeing these strong women achieve and believe in themselves, it's inspirational.
Were there any people there who were being slightly snotty and dismissive, or was the whole place just rocking with positivity?
From what I could see, it was very, very positive. I mean, I think I was just drowned with Sweet Caroline seemed to be played every 5 minutes. It's coming home. It seemed overwhelmingly positive. As I say, a lot of young children, I think, of course, they're on summer holidays, dragged mum and dad down to the parade, been waiting for hours and hours. And I think, to be honest, in an environment like that, there's no space for any negativity, even after they've won the Euros. Again, Serena Wiegmann, of course, bringing the vibes. I think it's just...
Let's talk about Serena Wiegmann, because... so her favourite artist is Burna Boy. And, I mean, if you've just got a couple of moments spare and you want to lift your spirits this afternoon, just take a look at the clip where they promise her on stage that she's going to have a real treat coming. And she genuinely can't believe that it's burner boy. So did you actually see all of that happen?
It was her face. You could see the pure joy just come into her face. I've never seen her that happy before. I think even when they won on Sunday, I think it might have matched that level. And then she just broke into song and dance, a duet between Serena Wiegmann and Burna Boy. I've never seen anything better, honestly. And it feels like finally, she's won 2 Euros before this, of course, but I think she's finally let loose and she's decided, I'm going to have a dance and a party. And when you look down and see, like you said, 60,000 people cheering you on and your achievement, I think that must get to you. And you could see on her face, I think she was just soaking it all in. And, you know, we talk about how she's going to receive this honorary damehood and just the plaudits that they deserve. But yeah, what a way to celebrate. It was like a Burna Boy concert and a Lioness's parade rolled into one.
Yeah, it just looked absolutely wonderful. It really did. We know that Prince William is a genuine football fan and he took Charlotte, didn't he, to see the game. So hopefully we've got another generation coming through who are genuine football fans. Did you see any curtains twitching at Buckingham Palace? Do we know whether Princess Anne was out there? You know, it was anybody else? Did they even acknowledge it's happening in their front porch?
I don't know. I heard some people in the crowd talking about this. Someone had binoculars. They were trying to see if anyone was looking out the window, any royals peeking out. I mean, they'd have had a great view if they were looking from there. I didn't see any. I'm thinking maybe they were undercover in the crowd, actually. That's probably a better place to be, isn't it?
Yes.
Sweet singing along, getting the scarves.
I could really
out.
See the Princess Royal getting into that.
Yeah. Having a dance.
So, Uma, what happens now? I mean, all of the Lionesses, boy, do they deserve a rest. They need to clear their systems.
They will have a little rest, although I should say probably not too long, because the WSL season gets going at the beginning of September. So for a lot of them, they'll be back to pre-season in a couple of weeks. I'm sure they will have time to celebrate. But yeah, I think for them, they'll see obviously they've achieved this wonderful thing, but now it's about the next step. And I saw somebody handing out flyers advertising the first set of WSL games when they start back in September. And that's the next step, because we saw how big the league became when they won it in 2022. Now I think the challenge is for them to sustain that. And also, I suppose, on an international level, I heard a lot of people saying, now we're going to win the World Cup in 2027. Obviously, we're 2 years away from that. But that's the journey now. It's about a constant state of building. And I think that's always been their mindset. What next? Yeah.
But the interesting thing will be to see whether the rights change at all, because obviously what will make an enormous difference to the women's game worldwide is if it can achieve the same kind of financial power that the men's game does. So put that into perspective for us. How much closer are we to that kind of parity?
Yeah, I mean, we are close, but I think when you look at we're close getting to a point where it's on the road to that, but still, I suppose when you look at the prize money, I think it was £41 million that they were awarded for winning the Euros. And if you compare that to the men's, it's about £330 million. So we're not on the scale at all.
But the audience figures have been unbelievable, haven't they?
They have been great. I think it was a total of 16 million who watched the final. And when you look at things like the WSL, the league, of course, the Emirates, certainly with Arsenal women, who I'd say are the biggest team, they got to a point where they were selling out the Emirates regularly last season. They've moved there permanently now. Other teams like Everton, who are now moving into Goodison Park, that's a huge step. Mm. And if you can get to a point where you can say that women's football, even at league level, is selling out the big stadiums, that's the point where it really goes, okay, now as a broadcaster, you can't ignore the fact that this is a point where you have to invest. And I think this should be a big sign that actually when it's given the coverage it deserves, it does get those eyes on it.
I think the Goodison Park thing is really interesting, because I think I'm right in saying that that was the location, Goodison Park, of that game that was thousands of people there back in the 20s.
The Dick Kerr ladies.
Munitions factory workers.
Yeah.
And that was the game that I think started the FA on that course of banning women playing in the stadium.
Exactly. And part of it was because I think a lot of the authorities, I should say men in power, felt threatened by the eyes that women's football was getting on it at the time. And, you know, that's why they decided to ban women from playing on FA-affiliated pitches. But it just kind of makes you think sometimes, if that had never happened, how much quicker could we have got to this trajectory? We lost 50 years of growth. We were already at a point where almost 50,000 people are in a stadium to watch a women's football match. We're kind of getting back to that point now. But it's remarkable to think that without that gap, we could be, I don't know, on par with men. Perhaps we will see.
Well, you never know. I guess some people might say when the women, and it probably will come, certainly in your lifetime, start earning enormous sums of money for playing professional football, maybe we'll be less keen on them. I mean, we love them. We love them now because we know they're ferocious battlers who've done us proud and aren't earning a ton of money. But what if that changes?
Won't it just be a different kind of love? And I know exactly what you mean. At the moment, they feel close to us, don't they? Because
Exactly. Because
their lives are closer to our lives. And you're right, once it's Lamborghinis and hilltop mansions and all of that kind of stuff, anybody feels distant. But the adoration, I think, would still be there, wouldn't it?
Well, men adore the other men who get away with all that, don't they?
Some women adore the men,
and
Jane.
I was only thinking this the other day. I've loved football all my life. But what that's always meant has been that I've been told I love men's football.
Yeah.
Because that was all that was available to me. And you know what? It's really made me think about what I should do now. Should I stop watching men's football and only focus solely on women playing football? Because most men only watch men, don't they?
But exactly. When you were younger then, so when you were, 15, 16 years old, if you'd been, a teenager now, would it only have been women's football that you followed? Would you have followed both?
Just don't know. I mean, I don't understand what it must be like to be you, frankly, and to have that, because women's football has been something you've focused on for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been. And I think ever since it was available and something that actually I could say, I am going to follow this as my primary sport. And while I do enjoy watching men's football, I'd say I enjoy watching women's football more because as somebody who plays football as well, I feel like you connect more to the players because you think this is a game that I play.
Do you have different women's team to men's team that you support?
I do. And actually, really? There's a very interesting reason behind this. So I was raised as a Manchester United fan by my dad. But when I got into...
I'm so sorry.
I know. I say this to him all the time. But when I got into women's football, Manchester United didn't have a women's team because they decided not to invest in their women's team for about
Alex
13
Ferguson,
years.
But actually, your dad would have been presumably heyday of Manchester.
Well, he got all the good years and now I'm suffering for it. But as a result, I chose to support Arsenal women, also because we live in London and it was closer to get to the stadium I wanted to go to the games. But yeah, now Manchester United do have a women's team, but I feel bad going back to just leave Arsenal women. Also, they're far better.
They won't look I'll stick with Arsenal women.
Fair enough. Stick with it.
Can we just say good luck to Michelle Adjaman on her return to university? I mean, everybody changes a bit during the summer holidays. We all know that, but imagine. So she goes, she's at King's College London, isn't she? So she walks back into the college refectory and, I mean, people would just be standing on the tables and shouting for her. And she seems like a young woman with such a clear head, but I do wish her luck, don't you?
I can't even imagine. How can you go into lectures now? It's all going to seem a bit boring to her, I'm sure.
Boring?
And then she's got to get ready for pre-season as well. Yeah. So, yeah, she's got a busy couple of months ahead of her, I'm sure. Next star.
Well, it's been an absolute joy talking to you about this tournament, Uma. So, let's hope that the next tournament we have equal positivity, equal results. But thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Lovely to speak to you.
Fantastic. And congratulations to you, because I do feel that you're largely responsible for the Lionesses.
All along.
Yeah, it was all down to you. And you can catch Uma on TalkSport. Right, we should say as well, the Women's Rugby World Cup is also heading our way. We haven't forgotten the Red Roses. I don't want to heap pressure on them, but obviously they've got a lot to live up to. In fairness, I think I saw on Instagram they were going into training wearing the three Lions football strip.
Excellent.
So they're backing them all the way. What's next? The UK sanctions on Russian money survive a court challenge. But what is happening to all of those frozen millions? It's just after 2:30. Here are the headlines on Times Radio. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The International Monetary Fund has upgraded its growth forecast for the UK and US economies, acknowledging the hit from President Trump's tariffs has not yet been felt in the world economy. The Washington-based fund said global growth prospects had remained resilient after announcement of US tariffs in April, which have been lowered for the UK, China and the EU ahead of an August the 1st deadline. Nigel Farage is calling for an apology after a cabinet minister accused him of being on the side of predators like Jimmy Savile. Peter Carl has criticised the reform leader over his opposition to new online safety laws and his pledge to repeal them. Kemi Badenoch explains why she's also against the bill.
This is the story of our times. More and more and more rules. Good people having to deal with more and more burdens, whether it's on migration, whether it's on business taxes, and then the bad guys find ways to circumvent. And that's what we're seeing. VPN usage has shot through the roof.
The Lionesses have lifted the European trophy in front of Buckingham Palace in London after an open-top bus parade. Thousands of fans lined the mall to cheer on England manager Serena Wiegemann and her team following Sunday's final win over Spain. Donald Trump insists he's working with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to get Gaza straightened out. The Hamas-run health ministry says more than 60,000 people have now been killed since October 2023. A Russian strike on a prison in Ukraine has killed 17 people and left more than 80 injured. Ukrainian authorities say no prisoners escaped despite two buildings being damaged. And Ozzy Osbourne fans will be able to say goodbye to the heavy metal star tomorrow with a procession taking place through his home city of Birmingham. The star's hearse will head towards the Black Sabbath Bridge, where thousands of fans have left flowers since his death. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
To whoever finds this letter, my car broke down. There is nothing nearby. And I've already eaten my meal deal sandwich. Please tell my wife that I love her and that she was right. This jacket isn't waterproof. Signed, Daniel S. Oh, actually, scrap that. Green Flag's just arrived. Blimey, less than an hour.
Local rescue, nationwide. Nothing beats near. Green Flag.
On average, we get to breakdowns in under an hour based on app and phone callouts combined between July 24 and June 25.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 5% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that dream holiday or a weekend getaway. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.89% gross. Terms apply.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Lots of lovely messages this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for all of them. Viv says, I hope that the women's football doesn't go the same way that the men's do financially. One of the reasons they are so supportive of each other and love each other and play so beautifully together is because they haven't got that financial axe hanging over their head. And Kate says a similar thing. It's wrong to aim for that silly money, isn't it? And this one from Yolanda, who says, well done, Lionesses. I hope when you all start earning your fortunes, you won't start gobbing on the pitch like the men. You never know. Are those two things a correlation? I'm not sure. But I hear what you're saying. And I think it's a really, really interesting point to have made, Jane, just about, you know, if there is a stratospheric wealth attached to future generations of women's football players, whether we'll look back and feel rather nostalgic for these times, or whether that's actually a bit of a parochial view. Why shouldn't they aim for the stars? And if that's money, so be it.
John Pienaar, who's a fan of Crystal Palace, and for years they won nothing, and then they did.
Yeah, yeah.
TV. That's the men we're talking about.
We are talking about the men. I mean, I'm never going to come down from that. If we're talking about how long can a celebration go on, the answer is a very, very long time. So loads on the programme today. I mean, we will start with a developing story. You'll have seen this beginning to, you know, sort of come through the headlines, that women, five women in Yorkshire, have alleged, and police are now investigating, their allegations that they were raped and abused by police officers at the same time that they were victims of the Rotherham grooming gang. That is, again, breathtaking. It adds another entirely new dimension to that awful story. It's being investigated by the Serious Crime Unit in South Yorkshire Police. Alexis J., the South Yorkshire, well, she commented, as we know, and reported on this whole scandal. She's saying it should not be looked at by South Yorkshire Police, but elsewhere. And the accounts, it's reported there in the BBC, it will be spreading far and wide as we speak. The accounts are absolutely harrowing of what these women went through. So we're going to be talking about that story and getting reaction at the top of the programme. And we are also looking at what, in a very different way, is also an important story. The government's plans, Keir Starmer's cabinet plan, for a way through in Gaza. Now, obviously, at first flush, Britain is not a big player in this, but is not a huge presence on the global diplomatic scene. But there is a plan. It's going to be spelled out by David Lammy at the UN a bit later on in the afternoon. And so we're going to look at that plan. I mean, what it means, certainly, obviously, for for Starmer, because it's an echo of the past when Britain was a big player, and someone has to come up with a plan because no one has one. The Israeli government has zero plan for the day after the conflict. Donald Trump's plan has been to turn Gaza into the Riviera by the Mediterranean, which is obviously outlandish beyond belief. And there was a plan from Egypt and Jordan for what to do in Gaza, but it was shot down the moment it was floated. So we're talking about this British plan and talking probably as much about why it's likely to go nowhere as to what might become of it.
Right. Thank you very much indeed. John Pienaar takes over from us at 4 o'clock this afternoon.
A business associate of Roman Abramovich has failed in an attempt to overturn British sanctions against him. He's a man called Eugene Schwidler, a joint Anglo-American citizen who grew up in Moscow and was sanctioned after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He took his challenge to the UK Supreme Court. Judges backed the government in a 4-1 judgment against him. So what is happening to the foreign money that once saw London branded Londongrad? Tom Burgess is an investigative journalist and the author of Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World. Tom, good afternoon to you. How much of a victory is this for the British government?
Good afternoon to you. I'd say it's more like part of a rearguard action, really. There is an enormous mismatch between the resources that are available to these oligarchs, to those who have profited from Putin's kleptocracy, and the arms of the British state that are supposed to fight financial crime. So in this case, what we've had today is a ruling that allows the government to continue imposing sanctions. What that doesn't equate to is effectively enforcing those sanctions to the point that they might have some serious effect in Russia. And beyond that, what it doesn't amount to is really ending or even challenging the status of London as the world's hub for dirty money.
Okay, we'll ask you more about that in a moment, but can we just have more on this man and his links to Abramovich? And presumably Schwidler benefited because he was linked to a man who was very closely linked to Putin, correct?
Well, you know, we all keep using this word linked, and this is the difficulty with sanctions. Schwidler's arguing that this is an infringement on his freedoms. In fact, one of the dissenting view among the judges agreed with him. And this is very murky territory. It's absolutely true that there is a kind of coterie of corrupt oligarchs who have this parasitic relationship with the Russian state that have grown very, very, very rich and support Putin's monstrous regime in doing so. But at the same time, sanctions are not imposed by courts, right? Sanctions are imposed by politicians, ultimately. This isn't the Serious Fraud Office or the National Crime Agency or even the intelligence agencies trying to build a case that is ultimately put before a jury and a judge. This is what a government says someone has done wrong. And this is ultimately the problem with sanctions, right? That no one's really testing the facts underlying them.
So here we are then. The court has ruled 4-1 in favour of the sanctions continuing. But effectively, you're saying the sanctions, they don't do anything, they don't change anything, and they certainly don't impact on the thinking of President Putin.
Well, I mean, I've reported from Ukraine and at the front line there where Putin's drones and missiles and bombs are making life a living hell. I think people will say to you, look, if you can do sanctions, do anything you can. And it is the case that sanctions make life a bit harder for those that they are they're imposed upon to the extent that they work. But it's also true that the UK isn't really doing very much to punish people who evade these sanctions, right? Typically, the worst you might expect to get is a kind of warning letter if you are someone who's subject to sanctions or someone who's done business with someone who's subject to sanctions or one of the many, many massive law firms and so on who have worked for these oligarchs and other cronies over the years. So it would be very hard to make the case that these sanctions are really biting.
So Londongrad and the notion that this city we are broadcasting from now, is awash with dirty money. How would we know, the citizens of London who go about our business, buying things, doing things, how would we know?
Well, it's the whole point of it is that it's made to look legit. This is what money laundering is. It's laundered, right? It's washed. So, but there are in fact tours of some of the more salubrious parts of London, where you can be shown the huge properties that are owned by former ministers from this or that ex-Soviet republic or this or that relative of a let's say a Middle Eastern despot. That property is all around us. Then you might go to an art gallery, and you might ask the question about where is the money coming from that's flooding into the art market. You might take a train out of London and go to one of the old private schools, and you might ask where are the funds coming for this influx of kids, of politicians and other business people from, let's say, the former Soviet Union. You might even go to Westminster and ask the treasurers of the main political parties what checks they do on the enormous political donations that come into our political parties, Conservatives, Labour, all of them really, and that shape our democracy, but are made by people who made their fortunes in these kleptocracies. This money is everywhere. Some of it is invisible, and some of it we just turn a blind eye to.
And we turn a blind eye to it because in some ways it suits us to have it. And if we don't have it, someone else might get hold of it. I mean, is that the reasoning?
I think you're... yes, I do absolutely see that point. I think part of it is absolutely we want to have it. I mean, in a way, the weakness of our financial crime law enforcement amounts to a big sign over the UK that says, look, we used to have an empire of our own. Now we want the fruits of other people's. We want the fruits of private empires. We want dirty money. But at the same time, it is important that there is at least a semblance of the rule of law, because that's what's attractive, right? If you're a Kazakh oligarch and you've made billions down the barrel of a gun, you actually quite like the fact that there's the rule of law and property rights in the UK, because it makes it harder for the next guy to steal your mine or whatever from you if you've listed it on the London Stock Exchange. So it's this delicate balance between turning a blind eye to dirty money and maintaining at least a whiff of the rule of law.
But China would take this money, would it?
Well, I'm sure anyone... I mean, who in the world turns down enormous sums of money? I think that the point is, would people want to park their money in China where there isn't really the rule of law? This is my point. What we're doing really is selling, commodifying our greatest asset, which is the rule of law. Because if you wanted to park your a few tens of millions in a piece of property in, let's say, Shanghai, and you fell out of political favour, that would just be seized. Mm. In the UK, there are independent courts, and this is the irony of the situation. It is the rule of law that is being used to shield the world's despots and their cronies.
Yeah, so I mean, it is crazy. Yeah, illegally,
it is absolutely crazy.
Illegally obtained money is protected by the rule of law in our democracy.
Yes, and it's beyond that, it's protected by a book recently called Cuckoo Land, which is partly about how the legal industry goes to work for those who get rich through crime, essentially the oligarchs and other big wielders of dirty money. You know, the criminal justice system in the UK, as you know, as we've all been reporting, is in a terrible state. You know, it's a pitiful proportion of, let's say, rape trials are brought to charge and trial and conviction. But the bit that's working really well is the civil courts, where still today oligarchs who are under sanctions can get a license from the Treasury, and they seem to be doled out pretty liberally, to hire the finest legal minds in the UK, huge legal companies, and fight their divorces and commercial disputes and so on in those courts. So we continue to benefit, and our legal industry continues to benefit from a massively lucrative oligarch legal scene, yeah, if you like, while the rest of the rule of law withers.
I mean, I'm increasingly, my mind is thoroughly boggled by this. And presumably the government, could it do something about the legal companies which choose to represent these people? And if so, what could they do?
Well, I mean, I've done this. I and a lot of other investigative journalists. We've been to the High Court. We've been sued by oligarchs. We've tried to fight this fight. I think that ultimately, when it comes to your questions about the law firms themselves, I think when it comes to that, there has to be some financial penalty for law firms that bring abusive lawsuits against journalists. For example, the brilliant journalists at Bellingcat, there was an outrageous case where they were basically bled of money by a law firm acting for a Russian mercenary. But there are life-changing amounts of money to be made for lawyers who are prepared to act for these clients. And until the incentives change, until maybe you wouldn't be able to claim those fees if you were shown to have abused the system, then all the motivation is to keep doing it.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Tom Burgess, who's an investigative journalist, and he's written a number of books. Cuckoo Land is one. Kleptopia, How Dirty Money is Conquering the World is another. Quite a dangerous job. Coming up, the BMA is accused of risking lives over blocks on strike exemptions. That and more with our resident GP, Rachel Ward. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
John Pienaar on Times Radio. Trusted journalism.
As you've heard already, some of the material is so sensitive, wounding, difficult to hear, especially for the loved ones of the victims in this case.
Intelligent analysis.
It's been called a new industrial revolution, which may be overexcitable, but it certainly feels like one.
And diverse opinion.
For Britain to succeed as an economy, as the home of public services that are broken and on their knees, this plan has to succeed.
John Pienaar at Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio. Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
DJ! At Plusnet, we think switching broadband should be as easy as flicking a switch.
Switch!
With One Touch Switch, our team will handle all the admin, helping you wave goodbye to your old broadband provider and get set up with us instead. Switch to Plusnet today and get fast and reliable full fibre. That's A++.
DJ!
Plus. New customers only, 24-month contract, limited availability, terms apply.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
Cruise into summer with Marshall Motor Group's sizzling summer bonus. Part exchange your existing car and get an extra £500 towards your next one. New or used, we have 20 of the biggest and best car brands to choose from. And with over 130 stores across England, chances are we're just around the corner. To find your nearest store and get your sizzling £500 part exchange bonus, visit marshall.co.uk today. Marshall, great cars, right up your street. Offer ends 3rd of August, terms apply. See marshall.co.uk/bonus.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, the NHS has accused the BMA of risking patient safety after they rejected 18 requests from NHS hospitals for doctors to break the strike and stop patients coming to harm. Senior NHS medics request exemptions under exceptional circumstances to protect patient safety. Let's talk about this with Dr. Rachel Ward, GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Rachel, these exemptions are known as derogations, aren't they? They are in place in case the NHS hospital feels that its patients are going to be at risk through strike action. We came across these in previous strikes. Is it different in this strike? And in which case, why?
Good afternoon. Yes. Yeah, so some of the rhetoric going around is that hospitals have been encouraged to try and request the derogations to potentially a lower threshold. And the BMA's comeback is that they are saying that some of these have not been appropriate requests. I find it actually very interesting. So there's been 47 requests up until Sunday, and that has requested 125 doctors to go back to work. Now, if you look at that, at 125 doctors is a tiny proportion of the number of people who are actually required to run hospitals across the country. And I think in my mind, this just shows how little capacity there is in the system, how easily things are on a knife edge and can tip over very easily. So one of the examples of one of the requests was for a doctor to return to hospital in Milton Keynes because he had a list of people coming in to have prostate biopsies. Obviously, this is really important because you're essentially looking for prostate cancer. But again, I think these are very interesting examples because it is just showing how actually kind of really core investigations are reliant on our junior staff and how, as I said, how little capacity there is in the system and how quickly that house of cards falls down. I think my comeback with this as well is to be, you know, the question of the safety element. I think most doctors, whatever their view on strikes, would say that at the moment there are safety elements every single day in the NHS due to the fact that there are so short-staffed with nurses, doctors and other health professionals. So that's an ongoing concern.
Right. Thank you for that. Let's talk about a new drug to treat Alzheimer's. I mean, anyone who knows somebody with Alzheimer's really wants to hear news like this. Is this a day that really does take that hope and optimism forward?
Well, yeah, there is some optimism around this drug. So it's called trontinemab. I think that's how it's pronounced. And it has had phase two trials. So that's, you know, the second stage, phase one is really checking that it is safe in humans. Phase two is looking what kind of biochemical or physical markers are changed. And what they found was that in 91% of people who were given the drug, there was a reduction in the amyloid plaques in the brain. And this is what we see in people's brains who have Alzheimer's. So that is very encouraging. Now, the next step is to really see whether that correlates with slowing down of symptoms, later onset of symptoms, and a significant reduction. So we are not completely saying yet that this is, you know, this is the treatment, this is what we need to do, but it's positive. It's a step in the right direction. So phase three trials are planned, and let's just really keep everything crossed that this is going to be a really good outcome.
Definitely. We join you in that. Why should you never, ever let a pet lick an open wound, Rachel?
Well, yes, this comes from a story of a lady, June Baxter, who sadly died at the age of 83 of septic shock. And she had a wound which her dog licked. Now, dogs have different bugs in their system, in their mouth, in their gut to humans. They're obviously different organisms. But there was a bug which passed over and did cause an infection in this lady, a Pastorella bug. Now, it's something that doesn't frequently cause infections in humans, but it has been seen before. And this was a case where it does happen. Now, look, thinking about this, of course, we are not saying that every time a dog licks you or licks something, you are going to have a severe infection. But I think it is a warning that, you know, dogs do have different habits to us. I only look at my dog, at what he eats and licks and touches. And then if he's going to, you know, come and lick a wound, that is not good. I think it's just a reminder that if you do have some immunocompromise, if you are frail, then just be careful around animals. You want to keep wounds clean. I'm all for having, you know, a good exposure to bugs, not constantly washing hands and things like that. But when we're talking about animals, we just have to have this awareness and that they do have different hygiene habits to us.
Yes, they certainly do.
That's very well put.
Jane has been making faces in the studio that convey those different habits, Rachel. Now, we wanted to make time to talk about this interview with Harper's Bazaar with Mariah Carey, who has said that she simply doesn't allow herself to get older. Now, I didn't know that we had a choice in this. She has not publicly acknowledged her age, and she also says that she eats no carbohydrates and mainly Norwegian salmon and capers. Is she on to something, or is she mad?
I think this is a fascinating interview. And, you know, how many of us have that luxury to not acknowledge time and how time is passing in our age? I mean, I suspect not that many of us. Maybe this positive attitude about aging, maybe that does have an impact. But, you know, this kind of extreme diet and talking of having 15 hours of sleep per night. I mean, if you're having 15 hours of sleep per night, you must be missing most of life's stresses. and you know, all of these different stories, I think, to be honest, it's all a little bit unrealistic. But the flip side of this is, why not embrace our aging? You know, why not be somebody like Kate Winslet, who's the opposite end of the spectrum, a huge star who, you know, embraces the fact that we're getting old. We do have more lines because that shows our experience. And so it's an interesting one. I don't think it's science-based, but, you know, let's be honest, Mariah Carey does look great.
She does look amazing. She avoids harsh lighting as well. What does harsh lighting do to you?
Who knows? But I think one of the best things you can possibly do if you want to prevent aging is always wear a high SPF sun cream. Any dermatologist will tell you that. So maybe it's in the same realms of that approach. But yeah, if you wear your high SPF every day, that is the best thing you can do for your skin and your aging.
Can I just ask a quick question about the no carbs idea? Is it is it possible to live completely, I mean, I couldn't, completely carb free, honestly?
Well, I mean, even if you look at the fact that she has capers, there will be some carbs in that because they are plants. And they will have some natural carbs. I think some people get a little bit obsessed with not having, you know, breads, pastas, that kind of thing. But there's very few foods that have absolutely no carbs in them. Right. So, no, I don't think it's possible completely. But I think people have become very anti-carbs. But let's remember, you do also need it for your energy. You don't need to overdo the carbs. And, you know, there's some conditions like diabetes where being low carb is really beneficial. But if you're somebody who's really active or a growing young person, you need some carbs in your diet. So, you know, there can be a little bit, it's a little bit of an interesting take.
Yeah. Gosh, I mean, just the idea that Mariah Carey could kind of go on stage and do a 3-hour concert without having a big cinnamon bun at some stage. I don't like that. It makes me feel a bit queasy. Rachel, it's always lovely to hear from you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Also, if you're going to sleep 15 hours a night, that means that you go to bed at 10 p.m. and you wouldn't get up until 1 p.m. the next day. Now that's just wrong, morally, isn't it?
It's morally wrong. I'd also think about your sheets. I mean, they must be clammy. You must. I mean, presumably she has them changed every day, does she? Probably.
I mean, probably. I mean, she does look amazing, and it's horses for courses. But 50, I just couldn't make myself sleep 15 hours of sleep. I'm good at sleeping as well, Jane.
15 hours is, I would say, a good. What's 8 hours too many? Yes, it is. Get up and get at it, Maria.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
My bad. Well, I don't know what the time is because I'm channeling my inner Carey, but it's the middle of the afternoon anyway. In the next hour, should Britain recognise a Palestinian state? What would that actually mean? We'll talk about that. And you will meet the YouTuber who grew up and became a very successful entrepreneur. We could all learn something from Casper Lee after 3:30. Here is the latest news bulletin, Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Nigel Farage is demanding an apology after the Technology Secretary Peter Carr claimed Reform UK's leader was on the side of pornographers and Jimmy Savile for opposing new online age checks.
We have people out there who are extreme pornographers, peddling hate, peddling violence. Nigel Farage is on their side. Make no mistake about it, if people like Jimmy Savile were alive today, he'd be perpetrating his crimes online.
Mr. Farage wants to repeal the Online Safety Act and says it's been drawn out by people who don't know what they're doing. He gave his strong response to the comments.
Well, this is so absolutely disgusting that it's almost beyond belief. Just how low can a Labour government sink in its desperation?
So Keir Starmer says the legislation isn't censoring anyone and is to protect children from things like suicide sites. The International Monetary Fund has upgraded the UK growth forecast, saying Britain will be the third fastest growing economy in the G7 this year and next. It acknowledged that the hit from President Trump's tariffs hasn't yet been felt in the world economy. The IMF forecast suggests a global boost of 3% this year and 3.1% next. England's Euro 2025 winning captain Lea Williamson says their homecoming celebration in central London was unbelievable. The Arsenal defender admitted she was crying all the way down the Mall as they paraded the trophy on an open-top bus. She spoke to the thousands of fans who'd gathered outside Buckingham Palace before lifting the silverware again.
Obviously, we do it for us and our team, but we do it for the country and we do it for young girls. This job never existed 30, 40 years ago, and we're making history every single step. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay with us. This story is not done yet.
The Bank of England's Governor Andrew Bailey has blocked the Chancellor Rachel Rees from intervening in the regulation of financial technology giant Revolut. The Chancellor had been trying to organise a meeting to discuss the company's plans to become a fully-fledged UK bank, but Andrew Bailey scrapped it over worries it represented political interference in the bank's independent oversight of the city. Times Radio's business correspondent Dominic O'Connell explains why the Chancellor wants to get involved.
Well, Revolut is a very interesting company. It's probably Europe's biggest fintech company. Fintech is a bit of jargon for financial technology, worth about $65 billion. And at some stage, it's going to go public. It's going to list its shares on a stock exchange. And Reeves, of course, would quite like that to be the London Stock Exchange, given it's been struggling recently, rather than in the US.
New York's mayor claims the suspect in a fatal shooting in Manhattan was trying to target the National Football League, but took the wrong lift. 27-year-old Shane Tamura is accused of killing four people, including the lobby of a skyscraper housing some business headquarters. It's alleged he left a note blaming the NFL for a brain injury. And resident doctors, formerly junior doctors, aren't ruling out further strikes. Their five-day walkout in England ends tomorrow morning. Health Secretary Wes Streeting announced last week he wouldn't let the British Medical Association hold their country to ransom over pay demands the members insist are fair. And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It's 3 minutes past three. It is 1 year since the Southport attack claimed the lives of three young girls. And flags are at half-mast on public buildings all across the region, as many people remember Alice, Bebby and Elsie. Times Radio's Kate Borsi will be presenting her evening edition from Southport later on tonight, with Patrick Maguire as well. And we are going to talk to her in just a couple of moments' time. We are respecting the three-minute silence that is currently being held there in memory of those who lost their lives and the terror that followed too. The attack a year ago was also followed by far-right rioting across the country, and a report from the IPPR think tank suggests that the lack of places for communities to come together after austerity pushed people online and made it easier to radicalise them. Dr. Parth Patel is one of the authors of the report. Very good afternoon. Thank you for coming in. Just tell us a little bit more about the headlines from your report.
The report is really about common ground in Britain. And 1 year on from the riots, we think that common ground in this country is still shrinking. We harbour quite a lot of resentment to people who aren't like us, certainly more than we used to 10 to 15 years ago, say, and increasingly think about life in the public sphere as a zero-sum game. For me to win, you have to lose. That's a really toxic way to think about living as a nation. And this report is trying to get at that. And when we think about why that's the case, why do people think like this? Most people revert back to economics. It's about low economic growth. It's about long queues in public services, long queues in the NHS, the lack of affordable housing. All these things are true, but we think it's missing something. It's not just about resource scarcity. The problem is also about relationship scarcity. We spend a lot more time on our own, in our homes, on our phones, less time with our friends and family and socialising. We're more likely to watch a film on Netflix rather than go down to the cinema compared to, say, 10 to 15 years ago. That sounds mundane. We think that really matters. And that's partly because of a loss in the physical spaces where we can come together. Pubs, parks, community centres, libraries, I could go on. Those places have been ravaged by austerity, which started in 2010. And by this cruel accident of history in that same decade, we saw the mass adoption of the smartphone. And those two things have combined to mean that we are much more polarised than we used to be.
And of course, if you exist largely in the digital world for your information, you are so less likely to ever rub up against people who gently disagree with you, who are quite happy to listen to you but might want to point something else out. You can exist just in this place where people applaud your own sentiment, your own beliefs, and therefore you go down a path very quickly. But I put this to you, and I don't want to be quite so pessimistic, but have we not gone past the point at which a cinema or a pub or a community centre can help us with this problem?
No, certainly we haven't gone past that point. Just to think more imaginatively about what those places are today, right? People might not want to go to the cinema to the same extent they wanted to go to the cinema in the 1990s. People certainly don't want to be part of working men's clubs, right? But they do still meet other people. For example, most people today meet people they don't know, meet strangers at the school gates. They meet them through their kids. The kids make friends, they meet their kids' parents. That happens a lot. The way we design school gates matters then, right? Are the school gates designed that you have to just grab and go? Drop in, quickly grab the kids, chuck them in the car, go. Or are they set up such as you could linger 5, 10, 15 minutes, have a chat to a couple of people you didn't know from backgrounds probably quite different to yours because schools are generally quite mixed. And then you carry on. That would be quite a big change, we think, and quite an easy thing to do, actually, because it doesn't cost that much money and it's quite easy to design school gates in that way.
In what way? What would you redesign about a school gate?
I would redesign school gates, for example, to facilitate social mixing, to facilitate conversation between parents as they pick up and drop off their children. I think that's quite an easy change. It's one of the changes that we point to in this report that might enable more social mixing. And the thing we're calling for here that hasn't been present in government cohesion strategies of the past 10 to 20 years, and I'm not sure will be present in the cohesion strategy in the months to come, is a focus on social mixing. We should deliberately be trying to get people from different backgrounds to rub shoulders with each other. And that feels like a really honest and basic kind of truth. And we don't need to evidence that, except there is heaps of evidence about this called contact theory. It was important in America after Jim Crow. It was important in Rwanda after the Civil War. It's been important in Britain. We just don't use it anymore. And I think if we focused on that, that's a goal. We want more people to mix physically in person. That would do us a great deal of good.
So aside from at the school gates, where else do you think this mixing could take place?
Well, the high street. I think the high street is a good example of this. And probably the deterioration of the high street is the most vivid symbol of sort of this national sense of malaise. And I mean, I've seen up front, my parents run a corner shop, seen over the past 30 years how the high street has just been completely transformed, you know? Shops boarded up, strange decisions like benches removed from the high street. Why on earth did they get rid of the benches? And trying to bring back the high street as this sort of site of conviviality where people go and hang out, whether it's in a cafe to get a drink or a pub, or there's a park or there's a library, these kinds of things. People do still want these things. They want after school clubs. They want things to do that are much harder to access, either because they don't exist or they're much more expensive. And I think it's not too much of a stretch to reimagine the high street, to bring it back to life.
2 out of 5 of those people arrested for rioting last summer had already been reported for domestic abuse. I mean, these are serial aggressors. Do you not accept the fact that actually the idea that you might entice that kind of person to, you know, pass by their different coloured neighbour or their different neighbour in a high street, share a cup of coffee at Costa, chat to them at the school gates. Actually, we are beyond that. These are people who are aggressive. They are angry. They find their circumstances so challenging. They have gone in what most right-minded people would say is completely the wrong direction. How realistically do you get them back on your side, my side, our side?
I appreciate that challenge. And I think there are two things to think about here. 1 in 5 people in this country support the idea that violence against minorities and immigrants is sometimes justified. That's very high. 1 in 5 people think that. And there are two questions here. So can we persuade more people to reject that view? My view is yes. And by creating more places where people mix as part of that answer. But also, given the fact that some people will always have those views and will have a propensity to violence, as you describe, how do we actually stop them expressing that in physical terms, right? You might think, you might have racist views in your head. That's one thing. We should try and get people to reject that. But what we should also try and do is to make sure people don't express that racism in physical terms, certainly not violent terms. And that's what we saw last summer. How do we constrain or cage people to express racist attitudes into racist hate crimes? That's really important. That's possible. That's partly about social norms.
But also, Parth, these people aren't just racist, though, are they? So they are hurting the people they profess to love back at home. I mean, these are people who are beating up their partners. It's an astonishing figure to have come out of the data from the rioters. I mean, it's deeply troubling, actually, isn't it?
It is deeply troubling, yeah. It's a figure I hadn't heard of until you mentioned it. 2 in 5 people of those prosecuted have a history of domestic violence. And, I mean... In a way, it's deeply depressing, and in a way, I can't say I find that so surprising. I work in an A&E department as well. I'm a medical doctor by training, and you do see certain people who come back in through the A&E department that have certain characteristics that make them feel like they're an outlier in society. Something's happened such that they just don't conscribe to the same rules and norms that the rest of us do. And some of those people, those 2 in 5 people that have a history of domestic violence, that went out and committed hate crimes against minority ethnic people, they probably fall into that category. That's a different kettle of fish. And I'm not an expert here about how to deal with sort of the sharp end of people like that, but that certainly does matter. Sure. And that comes back into national security, the Home Office, the Prevent programme, why it thinks more about Islamic terrorism more than far-right terrorism. I think these are big questions that I can't speak to, but certainly people are.
One of the ideas in the report is to have a 21st century welfare fund. Now, what is this?
It's inspired by law. It's more than 100 years old now, actually. That was passed in 1920. That took a penny of every ton of coal produced and reinvested that into local communities, into recreational facilities like lidos and pubs, as well as sort of community care and ambulance facilities all across the country. And it gave towns a sense of identity. And it recognised the role of employers and businesses in community building. That's not just a job of citizens and government, it's also the role of businesses. So we've been inspired by that, and Sasha Hillhorse, the author of the paper, has sort of pulled that through into a modern day version that tries to connect three things: the decline of the high street, the rise of online giants, and the need for places where we can come together. And the proposal was essentially that we should tax either warehouses and distribution centres on the outskirts of towns, or an online sales tax of people who largely operate online, take some money from that and reinvest that in these community spaces that we need, the libraries and the pubs and the parks. And it's a way really for tax to catch up with the way in which we buy things, which has changed. Gone are the days where we would go to the high street and rock up to an Argos and flick through that massive catalogue. Remember how heavy that thing was? Those flimsy pages, and find the thing you need and jot the numbers down and give a post-it note to the person behind the desk, and this tiny shop manages to produce everything you want from this magic door. It was an amazing place to go. No one does that anymore. Well, literally no one does that anymore. But Argos pays more tax than Amazon does, because it's a bricks and mortar business.
So I quite often go to my local Argos. There's never a queue because everybody else is shopping online. So please,
I won't ask how old you are.
I'm very old indeed. thank you very much indeed for coming in. It's a really interesting report, and certainly that idea. I mean, it goes back to the kind of old-fashioned philanthropy of, you know, what set up the Bourneville estate, all those kind of things where a company goes, we're taking the community with us, not just going to exploit what the community can give us.
That's spot on.
Yeah. So thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Parth Patel, who is from the IPPR. Let's talk now to Kate Borsi, who is in Southport for us today. Kate, how are the events of a year ago being remembered there?
Well, hello, Jane. Hello, Fee. We're in Southport. Well, it's turned into a memorial gardens, really, outside the town hall, just on Lord Street, which is the main shopping centre. And we've just had 3 minutes of silence. It began at 3 o'clock, a minute for each of these little girls. And it actually ran on to 5 or 6 minutes. It extended to that period of time, I think, because the people here of Southport gathered in this small square were remembering and were taking their time to remember what is an awful day a year ago. There have been about 100 and 150 people in this square, and they stood, as I said, not for 3 minutes, but for 4 or 5 minutes, with their hands clasped, some of them with their arms linked, looking down and thinking and paying their respects to the families of these three little girls. Many people carrying a rose, which has come from a local florist, in order to make their tribute to the little girls. There's a corner here where I'm stood where flowers are being gathered and laid in tribute to the victims, but also to the families and the wider children affected by this tragedy as well. So it's been pretty sombre. It's definitely picked up in terms of the number of people in this area just wanting to come and, you know, pay their respects respectfully, quietly, and in a pretty sombre way.
Mm. So the evening edition will come from Southport today, and I know that Patrick Maguire will be with you, Kate. Who will be on the programme?
Well, we've spent a really long time, Fee, building relations within this community so that we can do today justice, but also try and get across to listeners to Times Radio exactly what this community have been through in the last 12 months and how it's affected them. Some of the people I've spoken to today describe of the double tragedy, the day, the attack on the three little girls at that dance class, but then also the next day, those violent riots which shook the town to their core. And I think a lot of people here are still really, really dumbfounded by how one tragedy can turn into that level of violent protest. So we're speaking to faith leaders today here in the town. We'll be speaking to Patrick Hurley, who's the local Labour MP. He'd just assumed position, actually, just before these riots took place. Patrick Maguire, of course, is from Southport, so he'll be giving us his reflections on the community here. And I've been out and about this afternoon, and you'll hear plenty of local voices just telling us what today means to them personally, but also what it means to the town as well as they grapple with the aftermath of those violent protests and then trying to rebuild, trying to find some good in all of this.
Well, Kate, it sounds like thoughtful and essential listening. Thank you very much indeed. So the evening edition with Kate Borsay this evening from 7 o'clock. Patrick Maguire will be with her too. I'd say give it a listen if you can.
It's Times Radio. It's 18 minutes now past three, and the Prime Minister has been laying out his peace plan for the Middle East at an emergency meeting of the Cabinet. Of course, Parliament is in recess, and Sir Keir Starmer has been in Scotland with Donald Trump, but he's now back. This is after Gaza dominated those discussions in Scotland amid all the concerns of a humanitarian catastrophe. So Sir Keir presented a European-led peace plan being drawn up by France and Germany to President Trump yesterday. Sir Keir has been facing mounting Cabinet and parliamentary pressure to recognise a Palestinian state. Let's have a word with Ruth Jones, who is a Labour MP for Newport West and Islwyn. Ruth Jones, you have been discussing this for quite some time. You feel passionately about the need for the Palestinian state to be recognised. Why?
Because it's an even-handed approach to the current conflict in Gaza. We recognise Israel. We signed the 1917 Balfour Declaration to recognise Israel. This, the recognition of Palestinian now, would close the circle, would make sure that we recognise both states as we search for peace and to ensure that the people in Gaza can live in peace and harmony as we go forward.
I must admit that the expression recognising a Palestinian state has been bandied around for much of my adult life. I'm still not absolutely certain what it would mean in practice. Can you explain?
Well, I'll do my best. I suppose it's to ensure that the people, the Palestinian people living in Gaza, know that their country, their land is secure. It should not be open to the will and whims of neighbours to come in and take land by force. But it should be a democratically accountable country, which is another part which will need to be worked out as we go forward to ensure that the people there are able to elect their government democratically, fairly and openly and transparently.
I mean, there haven't been elections in the Palestinian areas for, well, how long? When was the last democratic election there?
Somebody said nearly 20 years ago.
Right,
I think it was 2007.
Okay,
I'll
thank
check
you.
It for you.
Yeah. Quite some time ago, and honestly, practically speaking, the chances of Hamas saying, "Yep, we'll let a democratic election occur," really, could that happen?
I think this has to be worked out as part of the peace process as we go forward in negotiations with Hamas and with the Israeli government. It all has to be put into the melting pot, and I think Keir Starmer is now very much aware of the feelings, the strength of feeling of backbenchers like myself within the Commons of just how important this is. It's not just a symbolic declaration. It's really, really vital that people of Gaza know that we stand there and we want them to be treated equally with respect and dignity.
Can you tell us a little bit about what are widely believed to be quite passionate disagreements within the cabinet? Who do you think is on which side here? Indeed, perhaps it's not quite as simple as that. Tell us.
No, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think David Lammy's come under incredible pressure. I mean, I wrote to him myself last week and a few weeks before that. I know he's getting a lot of letters from backbench Labour MPs, so he will be feeling the pressure there, but also the cabinet members. And, you know, I don't want to bandy about names and rumours and things like that, but I believe there are a significant number of people in the cabinet who are definitely pushing Keir to say, look, we need to reckon. And he, I know he says it's when, not if, but we need to know when is when, because we can't just keep going on and on as we have been since, you know, 7th of October 2023. We need a peace process and we need timelines.
Yes, and timelines are, of course, hugely significant, or could be. Fia's just had a quick look, and those last democratic elections were in 2006. So, I mean, quite some time ago, and that was a victory for Hamas. But, of course, they've come nowhere near allowing other elections to take place since. What about the fact that the suffering, which, I mean, I happen to be looking at the screens in the studio now, those scenes are unbearable coming from Gaza. They must be impacting just about everybody in Britain who ever goes near a TV news bulletin or ever looks at a phone. Are your constituents in Wales, Ruth, contacting you on a daily basis about this?
Absolutely. I'm getting hundreds and hundreds of emails in from people saying, look, do something. This suffering is terrible. This is a man-made famine. You know, we've seen the famines in Africa, which are often because of failed crops and climate. But this is a man-made famine. People are literally being starved to death. And, you know, we need to do something about this. And my constituents are very caring, compassionate people, and they want to know that we're going to do something about it.
Yes. When, though, is or could be the right time? What about the idea of Britain joining with the French and recognising the Palestinian state at the UN Assembly in September? Would that be right?
That, to me, seems like a good idea. But I have to say, obviously, Keir Starmer has his own ideas. And in fact, this afternoon, we are due to have a briefing from as a parliamentary Labour Party about the situation in the Middle East. So I'm hoping we will get some news this afternoon.
Right. I mean, you're anticipating news around what time? Do you have any idea when you might get some intel?
In the next hour or so.
Right. OK, well, we'll obviously keep an eye on that. This notion of Keir working on a European-led peace plan, what do you know about that?
I'm obviously not part of the cabinet, so I only know as a backbencher what has been said in the Commons. And that's the plan. We work with our allies to ensure the best possible outcome for the people of Gaza. And I think that's the key. Working with allies, we can ensure we have a much stronger united front. You know, we have other issues with, you know, Russia, China. We need to make sure that we as European allies and, you know, within the European continent, if you like, we are all united in the way forward. And I think that's probably easier than trying to go for a UN declaration.
What concerns you about the relationship between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you actually believe that Donald Trump genuinely wields influence over the thinking of the current Israeli government?
I think he does, but I think my worry is President Trump can be a little variable in the way he deals with people. So what I want to see is a consistent approach to enable us to say to Benjamin Netanyahu, enough is enough. You need to come to the table. We need a proper lasting ceasefire, and we need to ensure that the aid and the medicines and everything else that needs to get into Gaza gets in quickly, because this famine is not going to be averted in a couple of days.
And also, it's troubling, I think, to many of us that there still isn't the possibility of reporters, journalists from major news organisations getting into Gaza. If that were to happen, I mean, probably we don't know because we don't know what they'd see. I wonder what you think the impact of that might be.
I think that's the reason why Israel will not allow the reporters in, because I suspect the damage, the infrastructure, well, the infrastructure I suspect has gone. I suspect the people living in tents, you know, no proper houses. You know, we talk about the airdrops. And I mean, the airdrops, if a parachute doesn't open, that could be a dangerous moment. Airdrops are okay up to a point, but we need to get the trucks in. We need 500 or 600 trucks a day getting into all sites across Gaza. And that's the problem. And I think that's why Israel is not letting reporters in, because they don't want the full reports to be actually attributed and got out into the world.
And I don't think it's unfair to say that airdrops look like a real effort is being made, but in practical terms, on the ground, if you're a 26-year-old woman with three young children, perhaps you're breastfeeding or trying to, how on earth are you going to get food as the result of an airdrop?
Yes, exactly. And I think that, you know, that can, because the airdrops are so infrequent, there's a danger that you get more panic and more people rushing and then more dangers rather than the organised trucks that have been coming in. So I think we need to push for more open the borders and make sure we can get the trucks back in again and have some sort of controlled way of dealing with it rather than the Americans and the Israelis dealing with it all.
Thank you. Just while you're with us, earlier today, your colleague Peter Kyle appeared on Times Radio and elsewhere. He said that Nigel Farage, leader of Reform, is, and I'm quoting here, siding with people like Jimmy Savile by opposing online safety laws.
You know, we have people out there who are extreme pornographers, peddling hate, peddling violence. Nigel Farage is on their side. Make no mistake about it, if people like Jimmy Savile were alive today, he'd be perpetrating his crimes online. And Nigel Farage is saying that he's on their side.
Well, that was Peter Kyle this morning. What do you think of that, Ruth Jones?
Well, I'm not sure that Farage is saying that he's on Jimmy Savile's side. But the fact that he wants to repeal the bill, the act, is deeply troubling, because obviously that is our safety net at the moment, to ensure that children and young people have to prove their, you know, they have to, if they're under 18, they should not be able to access these harmful images of violence and pornography across the piece.
But some would say that his phrasing was really clumsy. And of course, it's actually played into the hands of Nigel Farage, who's been able to go around the news studio saying how appalled he is that Peter Kyle has made this comparison.
I'm sure Peter has his own thoughts on that. And, he's not made an apology, and therefore I think the case rests at the moment. But certainly the fact that Nigel Farage wants to repeal the act is deeply troubling.
Thank you very much. The thoughts of the Newport and Islington MP, a Labour MP, that was Ruth Jones.
Do we know why Nigel Farage is so keen on repealing the Online Safety Act? What's his big beef against it?
Well, isn't it because... Actually, I'm not even going to pretend that I can give you an accurate answer to
I've
that.
Put you on the spot there.
You have slightly. And
during the news, no. We will do our own research into the subject, and we'll bring the listener, who deserves to know the detail, something firm. Because it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's not been a hugely popular bill as it passed through the Commons and then the House of Lords. There were so many issues with it from different camps. So it has been incredibly difficult to actually get it to the point at which it is an act. But I can't quite put my finger on what a repeal would mean and why you would want to repeal it. Because I think also there is a consensus that something needed to be there to update our ability to legislate against the worst kind of crimes. So it would be good to know, wouldn't it? Well, we'll try and furnish you with those facts.
Our producer, Felix, says there are free speech concerns.
Right.
But we'll bring you more.
Okay, Nigel Farage also features in this short advertisement that we are doing for some of our own services. So this is all about Off Air, the podcast with Jane and Fee, drops every evening around 6 o'clock. There's loads of stuff in it. And at the moment, actually, we had the most amazing email from one of our correspondents who had found herself in such a family pickle, where she discovered that her elderly parents had spent all of the family's money. They'd spent it on luxury trips, on taking cruises. They had lived the life. They'd taken all of the equity out of their house, and they hadn't told their adult children what they were doing. And it all came crashing down around them, to the point at which
They actually couldn't afford to put petrol in the car to get our correspondent's mum to her chemo appointment. We are discussing what that means, the fallout from it, how you get over stuff like that. It's one of the most extraordinary dilemmas that we have faced. So if you'd like to get involved with that kind of stuff, then you just have to listen to Off Air. There's plenty of more comedic elements involved. And we always have a big interview. So the likes of Anthony Scaramucci, Mary Trump, Harry Redknapp, Jerry Halliwell, Adam Buxton and Laura Bates. And last week we spoke to Janet Street Porter. She shared what it was like meeting Nigel Farage one evening.
I met him at Evgeny Lebedev's house at dinner. I think I met him a couple of times before, just at drinks parties and things. And then I went to a dinner and I obviously sat next to him and spent a long time talking to him. And he is a very engaging, you know, he's a bit of a laugh. He's a good conversationalist. There's no doubt about that. And at the end of the evening, I realised, right, I'm going home. I've got to do a show the next day. Anyway, he got up with me and he went, "Can I share your cab to Charing Cross?" And I went, "Why?" And he said, "I'm going to miss my last train." I think he was living somewhere in Kent or at the time. I said, "I thought you'd have a driver, aren't you? A stockbroker or something?" And he went, "Well, isn't can I just share anyway?" I let him share my cab, but whereas normally I would have not. But that's a measure of his persuasiveness.
Right, so that's Janet Street Porter. There was so much in that interview with her on Off Air. Right, we're going to talk to former influencer, now venture capitalist, real man who knows stuff about tech.
Oh,
it's Casper Lee.
That's just what we need.
It is, isn't it? Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. An investigation has been opened into the involvement of police officers in the Rotherham grooming scandal. The investigation is being overseen by the Independent Office for Police Conduct, which has directed South Yorkshire Police to investigate on its behalf. Around 65,000 fans lined the Mall in London to celebrate England winning the Women's Euros after beating Spain in the final. As well as lifting the trophy on an open-top bus, the Lionesses were joined by Burna Boy and Heather Small on stage. Forward Beth Mead says it's a day she'll never forget.
Yeah, pretty crazy. I had to put my glasses on a few times. I could feel myself getting quite emotional seeing how much joy we've brought to the nation, the amount of people that have come out and supported us throughout the tournament, and today the atmosphere, the adrenaline, the energy that was brought was insane.
Nigel Farage has called comments made by the Technology Secretary, Peter Kyle, absolutely disgusting. Mr Kyle said the Reform UK leader's opposition to the government's online safety laws puts him on the side of predators. As he prepares to leave Scotland after a five-day trip, Donald Trump says he and the Israeli Prime Minister are working together. The US President told reporters he and Benjamin Netanyahu will get Gaza straightened out. And a three-minute silence was held in Southport to mark 1 year since three schoolgirls were stabbed to death. BB King, Elsie Dot Sankum and Alice Aguiar were murdered at a dance class. For a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs. And a smart meter can help. Barry Henderson is the owner of Henderson's Restaurant in Edinburgh and has been using his smart meter as part of his efforts to waste less energy and be more sustainable.
The smart meter definitely has made us more conscious of our energy use, and we can modify our operation to help just be more efficient. As a vegetarian business, lots of our staff are vegetarian and very environmentally conscious, so using energy efficiently is definitely a key core value for us. It's definitely helped us save money, and it's also helped us be more sustainable, able to focus on where we're using electricity and become more efficient. I genuinely do recommend smart meters to other businesses. Like, I think it just gives you a more accurate picture of how you're using electricity and energy.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 5% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that dream holiday or a weekend getaway. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.89% gross. Terms apply.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Hi, my name is Casper Lee. Today I'm joined with my roommate Joe Sung, and I just made a video on his channel in which I got really sick. Someone dared me to get my arms waxed by you. I assume it was Viner who sent in the dare. I'm with my really good friend.
Well, this is a sizzle reel from the early years of our next guest. We should all know who Casper Lee is because he was one of the first to make it big on YouTube. He had more hits on his YouTube channel than viewers of our terrestrial stars like Michael McIntyre, Alan Carr, Miranda Hart and Rob Brydon put together. He started out in 2011, essentially becoming a professional teenager, detailing his life with humour and self-deprecation and gaining millions of subscribers along the way, sometimes with his co-pilot Joe Sugg. And by the time he was 20, he had written a book and starred in several films, but then he changed tack. And we now find him in his 30s as a tech investor and businessman, co-founder of Influencer.com, does what it says on the tin, a marketing agency that helps brands work with online creators ethically. He says he's also got business interests in talent management, student accommodation, and he's a venture capitalist. Oh. How does that make us feel, Jane?
Just tired. And angry. Slightly resentful.
So it has been a remarkable journey, and we say a very warm welcome to Old Fashioned Times Radio. Casper, how are you?
I'm great. I actually can't remember making any of those clips that you played before the start. So it's almost like I'm listening to another person from a different dimension.
And is that because you were so young at the time, because you made so much stuff, because you want to just forget about it?
I've got a terrible memory, so I think that might be part of it. We made a lot of stuff. I haven't uploaded in 5 years. And so, jokes aside, like, I'm so busy doing so many things sometimes that I struggle to take time out to go back and remember and reminisce in those times.
Is that quite a helpful thing to be able to do? Because an awful lot of people who put a lot of stuff of their early lives up online do come to regret giving everybody so much access to their younger selves.
Yeah, I wouldn't actually be able to. Well, I maybe could if I spent hours and hours and hours to go through absolutely everything I've ever said. I would struggle to actually be able to tell if I said something I would no longer agree with today. And I think that doesn't just go for YouTubers. I think all young people now have a voice with social media. And if I had access to that at 13, I think I would have regretted many of the things I said. So I was lucky enough to start when I was 16 and to kind of be intentional about it. And I knew, within a couple of years that this was going to potentially be a career. And I tried my best to not say anything I would go on to regret. But I'm sure if I trolled through everything or someone does that one day with AI, which is probably quite scary to think about, they might find something I don't really agree with anymore. But I tried my best not to get into too many controversies. Yeah.
Did you know quite how successful you were becoming? Was it easy to tell?
I was surrounded by other creators, so they were also becoming successful, and some of them were becoming even more kind of successful in quotation marks. And yeah, so I guess because of that, I never saw myself as someone who was too successful, because I think you compare yourself to other people, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm in kind of middle of the pack here, it's going well. But in hindsight, looking back, seeing the people I was able to make videos with, and seeing actually just as you spoke about some of the numbers, it's hard to believe that like younger me was doing that.
Yeah. Who were some of the people that you got to appear on videos with?
So I can't go 5 minutes without name dropping every single guest I ever had. I love talking about someone like Ed Sheeran, who came to my apartment at one point to make a video with me, or Kevin Hart or The Rock, or I even got to work with Her Majesty the Queen. She didn't do a video with me, but I got to meet her twice.
Really?
Because I was part of the Queen's Young Leaders, which was this organization that she had spearheaded. And it was kind of weird. I had this situation where I was sitting behind her for like 40 minutes. And I was like, I hope I've been vetted properly, because I'm way too close to the Queen right now. I can literally...
You can reach out and touch her. Let's not go there.
Yeah, I was like, what should I be? How detailed should I get here?
Oh, it would be so tempting to do that, wouldn't it? Wow. So what about the decision then to stop creating content, to stop being in front of the camera? You said it was a very deliberate one. But why? Did it stop making you happy?
Do you know what? I always loved editing videos. What I did find quite difficult was coming up with new ideas and also the treadmill of it all. And so I got to a stage where it was everything I ever dreamed of. But a new opportunity had arisen, and that was a business I'd co-founded called Influencer.com. We'd started working with many brands and creators to help them work together. And we just saw advertising in general going in that direction. And I thought if I wanted to continue to do YouTube very well, I had to give it all of my focus. But I wanted to try this new thing. So in hindsight, it felt very intentional. But at the time, I had this kind of opportunity to jump into another stage of life, which I'm really happy I did, and keep YouTube as this like, really happy memory in my life.
Do you think that people can age gracefully in modern times on social media?
When I was younger, I didn't think it would be something that I could still do as I aged. But actually now, seeing how I've grown up watching creators and seeing how those around me have, I believe that creators will age gracefully. I think it'll maybe be hard for some of them who are doing well when they're young, if they're making a particular type of content, to bring that with them. But if they can transition into content that other people enjoy as they get older, then 100%, because social media in general is just a new redistribution of media, and media is always allowed for older creators.
Yeah, I wonder about that, Casper. I mean, I admire your optimism for that, but actually I think that old media has been quite a cruel place for older people. I think youth has really sung and it's shone and it's been celebrated. And I suppose I've thought, well, maybe social media ends up being, on YouTube in particular, kinder to older people because you find your audience. And actually the audience that doesn't want to watch you simply doesn't watch you. It doesn't get involved and complain about you. It just moves on and finds what it wants.
Actually, that's a really good point. And I think that's because it's democratized reach. And so there's no gatekeeper telling you if you can make a show. You can go out and make that show, and there are audiences that want it, and maybe those were overlooked by traditional media. So that's a very good point.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the things you do then. You mentioned influencer.com, and I was intrigued to read that you want to be a very ethical marketing brand, global hookup agency, whatever it is, however it is that you describe.
Sounds like Hinge.
Okay. I've got it wrong again. Haven't I?
You do say
my terminology. It never helps me. But how do you, what do you mean by ethical? Do you mean that you wouldn't take on somebody who was, say, promoting anti-vax theories or something like that? How do you make an influencer an ethical thing?
So we work with brands at influencer.com. Most of the brands don't want to be working with people who are going to cause massive backlash against their brands. And so by nature of doing a brand deal online, you're usually working with creators who, by society and the zeitgeist today, are, again, inverted commas, ethical. There's so many different kinds of creators in the world, but the ones who do brand deals are the ones who usually aren't saying something too controversial in their day to day. The ones who do more controversial content are usually doing more subscription based content for a smaller audience who is paying them in another way.
Do you worry about the amount of disinformation that is now promoted online? And I know that might sound like a pretty basic question. So the qualifying part of the question is, I think people of our generation, Jane and I are definitely the generation above you, we're so horrified that some stuff can be out there that hasn't been checked by two sources, that doesn't have any, you know, detail attached to it. But I wonder whether actually your generation might be cannier, or do you think because you've never been exposed to a world that's checked its sources, it's all just going to fall apart?
I think there's people in our generation who are tricked all the time by misinformation, and I think there's ones who aren't. I just think it really depends. Again, so it's like your question earlier, like, you know, how do you work with ethical or non-ethical creators? Is there's so many different types of people out there in the world, and the problem is I can see a piece of content and I usually will try and verify it, but I will have a friend who might show me something they found on Instagram, and there's, you know, it's a big claim that has just been made and there's no source, and I'm just like, is that also, you know, is that really, have you checked anywhere else? And they're just like, well, no, it says it's real.
So what's going to happen to all of us?
it's kind of scary in that regard. I hope that these things kind of, the pendulum can swing back and forth, and people, when they get pushed too far, they can realize that they need to try and verify things more. But it can also be used as an excuse by bad actors who say, oh, yeah, just because they said it, that doesn't mean it's true. And so for us to say not everything you read online is true can also have a negative effect when something is true and someone's saying it's not. So I do think, I mean, I do think there is a world where AI can help to look into sources and try and give you, like, Perplexity, for example, is something I use when there's a big story coming out, and it can show you for
what's
all the,
what's that? That's an AI.
Perplexity?
Yeah.
And it's basically an AI tool that goes really well into many sources and tries to show you where that information's coming from rather than just feeding you the information without showing you.
Okay, we should definitely get on it, Jane, shouldn't we? Do you feel the generation gap when you're in business because you're incredibly successful? I imagine most rooms that you enter, you're the top dog in the room. What does that do to your perception of the generation above you? Well, you think we're all dinosaurs?
not at all. As I get older, you know, I'm 31 now, and I've been doing this for a long time. I realize that I feel exactly the same in many ways as I did before. And I think, you know, just being curious, being willing to take risks and so on is kind of something that people associate with younger people. And that's why they're like the great entrepreneurs. And that's why VCs all try and surround them, because they're like, you're going to be the age group that goes on to start businesses. But actually, there's been businesses started by all sorts of people at all sorts of points in their life. And I actually, you know, I had the kind of the reverse of maybe what some people think. You know, when I was younger, I had a lot of imposter syndrome going into these rooms with older people, and I've kind of over the last 10 years become not the oldest, but kind of a mid-level kind of age in the working environment, and it's been fascinating to see that and being going like, hey, actually I don't know everything. Just because I'm slightly older doesn't mean I know everything. And I think it's kind of the same on both sides.
Yeah. Are you happy to employ people who are much, much older than you?
Of course. We try very hard to. I will say they're sometimes more expensive to employ because they've got a lot of experience.
Well, you should be happy to pay for experience.
Exactly. We've got some incredibly experienced people who I work with every single day, and it's really great to learn from them.
Yeah. I do think that, and forgive the gender prejudice here, if a couple of middle-aged women had been more involved in setting up social media empires, things would have been an awful lot better. I think the simple idea that you were creating things where popularity was what counted. Any mum who's had to deal with the fallout of a popularity contest in the playground will tell you it's a really bad idea. Would you agree with me, Jane Garvey?
I'm slightly... it's lovely to have Casper in the room, but memories are coming back to me, and this might not have been you. But what was... Do you remember the tin can challenge?
No.
Maybe it wasn't you. Maybe it was Joe Sugg and somebody else.
Okay, yeah. I may have done it, but
sorry, I was listening to your question. Yeah. I'm talking to my colleague here. But I'm listening to Casper. It's all coming back to me that when I, as a parent, my children were in their early teens, they started watching videos of the tin can challenge. Really stuck with me because it was you just take all the labels off a load of cans and then you'd have to eat whatever was inside the tins. That was the first bit of content in speech marks I was shown by my offspring, and I was horrified, and I just thought, this won't take off. It's absolute gibberish. Why aren't they listening to the radio like I did when I was their age?
Yeah.
But amazingly, Casper, it has. Sorry, that's just my monologue on the subject.
No, I would love to. I want to go back and watch that video.
I'm not sure it was you, but it was somebody.
It's definitely not ringing any bells with me.
But as I said, okay. I probably wouldn't, even if I did it three weeks ago, I probably wouldn't remember.
Some of the pranks on YouTube and other platforms have proved to be unbelievably dangerous. Let's just acknowledge that. And let's take that into a question about online safety. I'm not expecting you to know the intricacies of the Online Safety Act, but do you think that any government can really successfully legislate against the perils of the internet. So many people have pointed out already that the big problem with the Online Safety Act is you can get a VPN if you want to get around the age restrictions that that act is imposing on sites. Simple. You know, within 2 seconds, you've completely undermined the bill.
Yeah, as you say, I looked at the App Store recently, as I try and do every now and then, to find out what do people download these days. And I saw like the top kind of 10 apps, 5 of them were VPNs. So that means a lot of people are doing that. That doesn't mean everyone's going to do it. And so it may be able to prevent, the Act may be able to prevent a percentage of people who shouldn't be accessing stuff, accessing it. But as you point out, people can find ways around the law, especially online, where, you know, there's VPNs and so on.
So ultimately, will it only all get better if it's the companies themselves who decide to make it better? And what's in it for them? They're making millions and squillions of pounds. Why would they change?
Yeah, it depends on what part of the act they're trying to do. And I think, yeah, it's a very important government there is there and exists to help represent the people. And as platforms become very powerful, they need to work with governments within certain countries to do that. But in terms of this act, what sometimes gets tough is when there's not all governments in the world doing the same thing at the same time. And you can kind of, as a person, literally transport yourself to another country. And that can also be a good thing. You know, VPNs can be good in places where governments are tyrannical and they're over-censoring, and you want to have access to this.
I just want to bring you the news that AI says that you've never done the tin can challenge.
Oh, but thank God.
It's all right, but other people have.
No misinformation from me on this podcast.
Or me on this occasion. Yeah.
Thank you.
I know that you've spoken before about your Tourette syndrome, so I hope you won't mind a couple of questions on that. It's a syndrome, isn't it, that's so often portrayed in a very extreme way. People immediately associate that with someone who can't stop swearing or, you know, can't stop the tics. How does yours manifest itself, and when did you know that you had it?
Yeah, so when I was 6 years old, I was watching TV with my sister. And I started making these noises, and she got really angry with me and told me to leave the room. And I went to my dad and I told him about this, and he kind of said, oh, I have something similar. But he didn't actually get properly diagnosed. He just saw the same thing in me that he saw in himself growing up. And for the next kind of 10 years, it just got worse and worse. And it was mostly physical twitches and so on. But there were, you know, there was verbal. And as you say, in the media, it kind of comes across as a swearing syndrome. But for me, it wasn't. And then as I got older and I, you know, got through puberty and adolescence, it seemed to improve. It's something I work on. It's something I take medication for. And when I'm in a very stressful environment where I don't want to do it, that's when it happens. But when I'm obsessed with something and I'm in flow, that's when it doesn't. And I really think that's why I started YouTube, because I could edit, I could be on camera in my own room. I wasn't in a high stress situation. And I was obsessed with it, and that's why I loved it so much.
You've also talked about social anxiety, and certainly feeling that during the pandemic.
Yeah.
I think it is always helpful to hear how people cope with that. So how do you?
Yeah, I don't know if this happened to any of you or your listeners, but during lockdown, because we were isolated and then we came out of it, I just started having this social anxiety where I didn't even want to get into a car with my own now wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, because I thought I was going to have a panic attack. And I did reach out and got help and spoke to someone. And over time, I started doing the things I was scared of very slowly and in a controlled way, as to not completely overwhelm myself. But as I started overcoming those things bit by bit, it improved. But even today, there'll be times where I get super nervous or anxious about situations. But I just think kind of by overcoming that fear, it helped me personally.
Yeah, and you are absolute proof that you can have a hugely successful and actually public-facing career with those kind of challenges and still, hopefully, I hope you get to enjoy all of that. Can we run some figures past you before you
Please.
Go, Casper? Right, I'm going to tell you. So
I'm not looking forward to this.
Jane and I do a podcast. We've been doing a podcast together since 2017. The total downloads for our podcast, and obviously for us, we're hugely proud of this, really proud of this, but we need your perspective.
Brace yourself, Casper.
Okay. You just got to be really honest and let us know in what ballpark you would regard our success. So our total streams, our total downloads are... I've forgotten the figure now.
Oh, God.
No, I haven't. 52.5 million. Is that all right?
Well, how many years are we talking?
Well, we used to do...
Gosh, I mean, that's not a good start.
We'll have to divide it by the years.
We've only been
Eight
here
years.
For... No, we've been here for 4 years. We're at the BBC for 4 years, but we only did one huge. A week at the BBC.
I mean, it's huge. But what I say when it comes to numbers, it's not how many are listening or watching it. It's who is listening and watching. And reaching a particular, you know, interest group... can be way, you know, more valuable to a brand or even more valuable to you as a creator than just going completely broad and doing the tin can challenge.
Which you didn't do, Casper.
Which I didn't do.
So most of our listeners are middle-aged women. So is that a good thing?
It seems to be, you know, the high net worth group of people sometimes, as I heard earlier.
Yeah, brilliant. I think that was a yes.
You know, the very experienced people who I'd love to hire at the business.
Okay,
yeah, you're saying all the right things now, Casper. Thank you very much. Casper Lee, Times Radio, 3:30 to 4.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Their well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Wait, no, 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 no!
What's so funny there?
My friend just sent me this.
I'm cooked. Absolutely cooked.
What's he cooking?
No, Mum. Cook just means he's in trouble.
Oh, I see. What's he in trouble for?
So basically there's this thing the guys at school do.
Keeping up keeps them safe. Talk to your kids about online safety. Tesco Mobile. It pays to be connected. Search Tesco Mobile Online Safety to learn more.
DJ!
At Plusnet, we think switching broadband should be as easy as flicking a switch.
Switch!
With One Touch Switch, our team will handle all the admin, helping you wave goodbye to your old broadband provider and get set up with us instead. Switch to Plusnet today and get fast and reliable full fibre. That's A++.
DJ!
Plus. New customers only, 24-month contract, limited availability, terms apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. On Times Radio.
It was lovely to get a burst of youthful vigour from young Casper, wasn't it?
And I think we got an endorsement. I mean, there was a pretty immediate caveat. Those are huge numbers, but I completely take his point. It's who's listening, not necessarily how many. We love all our listeners, don't we? And they will be delighted to be called high net worth individuals.
Oh, they certainly will. Times. What's the email address? Times, she said vaguely. Jane and Fee, times.radio. This isn't, say, a previous employer, in fairness to me. I could have done, though, easily. That is the email address if you want to take part in Off Air, the podcast, which comes your way at 6 o'clock Monday to Thursday. It's a lovely community. You too can be a part of it. It's free. Now, tomorrow's guest is Gary Newman. Wow. That's incredible. And on Thursday, I'm going to be talking to Daisy Goodwin, who's written a stage play about the relationship between the late Queen and her dresser. That's on Thursday.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio. The voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Fee. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar.
And this is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. Five women who were victims of grooming gangs have said they were abused by serving South Yorkshire police officers. And Kerry Badenoch tells me the claims are shocking. Sir Keir Starmer's holding a rare emergency cabinet meeting with his top team to discuss the situation in Gaza. And coming up, the latest on those allegations with the Times Special Projects reporter, and I'll be speaking to the Mayor of South Yorkshire. And you can hear my interview with the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. South Yorkshire Police have confirmed three former police officers have been arrested in connection with child abuse cases in Rotherham. Assistant Chief Constable Hayley Barnett says one is on police bail pending further inquiries and two have been released from bail while the investigation continues. That investigation is being overseen by Police Complaints Watchdog, the IOPC, and South Yorkshire Police are working alongside the National Crime Agency, they say, to help ensure they leave no stone unturned. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch told Times Radio, this is proof we need a national inquiry.
That's the only thing that's going to get to the bottom of what actually happened. And one of the things that has been quite striking about this story hasn't just been the scandal of the crimes and just the, you know, just the sheer wickedness of it, but where it seemed like the state authorities, whether it's councils, police, social care, that either looked away or seemed to have a hand in it. And I do think that that's something we must get to the bottom of.
And you can hear this full interview with John Pienaar at 4:15. Sir Keir Starmer is holding a rare emergency meeting with his top team to discuss the situation in Gaza. It's understood getting aid to civilians is top of the agenda, and there'll also be discussions about a peace plan led by the UK. Earlier, Donald Trump said he's working with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to try and straighten out the situation.
Mr. President, what will you see next to Benjamin Netanyahu?
We're working together. We're going to try and get things straightened out for the world. Thank you.
Nigel Farage has called comments made by the Technology Secretary absolutely disgusting. Peter Carr said the Reform UK leader's opposition to the government's online safety laws put him on the side of predators. Tommy Robinson is reported to have left the country after video emerged of him walking away from the scene of an alleged assault at St Pancras Station in central London yesterday evening. He was filmed shouting, "You saw him, he came at me," as a man laid unresponsive and bleeding on the floor. Robinson has now posted on X to say, if you cross a line and attack someone physically or threaten to attack them physically, a preemptive strike is totally legal. British Transport Police are investigating. The International Monetary Fund has upgraded the UK growth forecast, saying Britain will be the third fastest growing economy in the G7 this year and next. It acknowledged that the hit from President Trump's tariffs hasn't yet been felt in the world economy. The IMF forecast suggests a global boost of 3% this year and 3.1% next. Resident doctors, formerly junior doctors, aren't ruling out further strikes. Their five-day walkout in England ends tomorrow morning. Health Secretary Wes Streeting announced last week he wouldn't let the British Medical Association hold the country to ransom over pay demands the members insist are fair. England's Euro 2025 winning captain Leah Williamson says their homecoming celebration in central London was unbelievable. The Arsenal defender admitted she was crying all the way down the Mall as they paraded the trophy on an open-top bus. She spoke to the thousands of fans who'd gathered outside Buckingham Palace before lifting the silverware again.
Obviously we do it for us and our team, but we do it for the country and we do it for young girls. This job never existed 40 years ago, and we're making history every single step. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay with us. This story is not done yet.
And for a roundup of news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking. Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. It barely seemed possible that the story of the Rotherham grooming gangs could become more shocking, but shortly before we came on air, it did. It's now emerged that South Yorkshire Police are investigating allegations that five women who were child victims of the Rotherham grooming gangs say they were also sexually abused at the time by police officers in the town. Shocking, as I say, shocking, was how Professor Alex Jay described it. She said it is shocking that the inquiry is being left to South Yorkshire Police. And the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, told me in an interview that the whole affair was shocking and underlined the case as she sees it for a national inquiry.
Now, three former officers have been arrested and released while the inquiries go on, and I will have more on that breaking story shortly. And a little later, you can hear my interview with Kemi Badenoch. She has announced a new policy to ban strikes by doctors by law. And she shared and explained her view that the Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, is led by militants, politically motivated militants. I wonder what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, let's start then by saying hello, welcome, good afternoon to Tom Witherow, the Times Special Projects reporter, here with me in the studio. Hello, Tom. Good to see you.
Afternoon.
This is then a remarkable development in the grooming gang scandal.
Absolutely. And just reading some of these testimonies, which have been given to a law firm in the hope of winning compensation from South Yorkshire Police, and they're really the stuff of nightmares. There's one woman who said that she was raped from the age of 12 by a serving police officer in a marked car, and that he threatened her to go send her back to the grooming gang, who was already abusing her, if she didn't comply.
Goodness, shocking seems like an understatement, Tom. And these allegations, if proven, well, apart from anything else, Tom, they just seriously compound the evidence and the impression that victims in this scandal just felt they were left with nowhere to turn.
Absolutely. I mean, we already knew that police officers weren't believing the girls. This was across the police, the council, social workers. But to now know that there could be perpetrators amongst them is just unbelievable. I mean, this is really the case of the highest level of police corruption. And there's evidence in the testimony that the police were effectively working with the grooming gangs. A couple of the people who have been accused were dealing drugs to the gangs. And as in that story, you could see that they were using the threat of further and greater abuse. One woman who spoke and said that she had already been the victim of rape at the hands of 100 men to go back, send them back to their abusers.
And Tom, there surely has to be a legitimate question to be asked. And Alexis Jay has posed the question on how can it be right for South Yorkshire Police to be the force carrying out the investigation?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a massive issue. And this whole scandal has been underpinned by, you know, can we trust these institutions to look into something that has been so shocking and so long-standing and, you know, a real kind of stitch-up in the local establishment? Now, what South Yorkshire Police say in response is that they are doing this they're doing their investigation properly in the interest of victims, and that their work is being overseen by the IOPC, that's the police complaints body, and that they have been instructed to investigate on their behalf.
I guess this again has to be a political question, but we can look at it, and we're going to hear in a moment how Kemi Badenoch, not when I spoke to her just before the programme, she says that this whole affair was certainly shocking and that it reinforced her case for a national inquiry. I guess that would also be part of this discussion, won't it, Tom? I mean, here we're looking at specific offences, specific allegations, but we're also broadly looking at the culture in place at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the offending in Rotherham alone, which has obviously already been subject to the Alexis J.